I'm Vivian Penn, and we'd like to get started with the next part of our program. I'm director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at the National Institutes of Health, and I'm delighted to be a member of this very impressive committee that's putting on this meeting. I must admit, I'm learning a lot since I've not had experience in entrepreneurship, but it's really wonderful to experience the information and that we're learning about and hearing about today. And I have the privilege of introducing to you our next keynote speaker, who is Susan Wyndham Bannister, who was appointed in May of 2008 by the Massachusetts Life Sciences Center Board of Directors to be that center's first president and CEO, a position she assumed in July 2008. So she's been in that position for just over a year. Now, the center administers a $1 billion 10-year life sciences initiative, and she's often referred to as the billion-dollar woman. And actually, there's been a lot of attention to her response to being given that reference, and I'm sure she'll say a little bit about that, or she hadn't planned to, she'll need to now at least explain a little bit about what it's like to be called the billion-dollar woman, and if, in fact, that's a true title for her. But we know that she is in charge of a very important and sort of a landmark initiative in her position. She's previously served in many areas with experience as a consultant in life sciences, including at Apt Associates, and has been providing consulting services to firms with about life sciences, developing competitive commercialization strategies for large and small biotech companies, et cetera. She has also worked with government in terms of NIH and the CDC, so she's very familiar with academia as well as government, as well as the business world in terms of the life sciences industry. She's authored two books, Competitive Strategy for Healthcare Organizations and Medicaid and Other Experiments in Health State Policy, and sits on a number of boards of directors and is a graduate of Wellesley College, holds a doctorate in health policy and management from the Heller School at Brandeis University, and also was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School under fellowship from the Ford Foundation. So with that, without going on and on, which I could do to describe all of the accomplishments, or at least a few more of the accomplishments of Susan, I'd like to, in fact, preserve the rest of the time so that she'll be able to give her full presentation. Susan, welcome to the podium.
Vivian, thank you for that very kind introduction. I am so happy to be here. One is always in a position of being able to learn, and I have learned a lot by listening this morning, and I look forward to sharing my comments with you and dialoguing with you about this. Let me say, I've got a picture here. I know that most of you are trained in the empirical tradition, so just wanted to confirm that I am, in fact, Sue Wyndham Bannister. Let me say as well that my presentation today is going to blend some data, but I really invite you please to view what EJ and Laurel have presented as, you know, maybe the seminal data. I'm going to be showing data more to provide some context and to set some trends, because what I really want to talk about are my hypotheses, my observations, my own experiences. I don't have all the answers, but I certainly have a lot of thoughts, and I want to talk really about the business of science, which is really what I'm involved in day in and day out. My role blends the two with a very heavy overlay of entrepreneurship. So let's start with what I call the context or the symptoms. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this. There's a lot of data. We've covered much of it today. It's not a very pretty picture, so I'd rather move on to talk about what it is that we can do at the individual level, I think at a programmatic and policy level. And again, if my data seems just a little bit out of alignment with what you've heard earlier, I would invite you to think of the two earlier speakers that have done really primary research in this area to be providing some of the more seminal data. So what is the story of women in science? It's the story of a few. And I'm going to just run through these very quickly. Fewer women hold jobs in science and engineering than men by quite a large margin. Although, as you've heard this morning, we often start off in equal numbers, but somehow when we get through the funnel, there are fewer of us than there are men. We earn fewer, we get half the degrees in the biological sciences, but when we get into the position of tenure track and postdoctoral programs and tenured faculty positions, there are fewer of us. Fewer than 3% of us hold Nobel laureates. And 1 year after graduation, we are earning fewer dollars. So when you look further, it's not just a story of the few, but a story of the fewer. While there were more women than men in the top 10% of fundable NIH grant applications, there are fewer grants per PI among women, fewer dollars per grant awarded to women, and fewer rates of successful application. So it is a story of the few and fewer. When you look at women entrepreneurs, it's a somewhat better story, but it's still not a great story. You heard EJ say this morning, and my data is the same as his, when you look at the primary owner of a business, about 28 to 30% are women. When you look at privately held businesses where women are a partial owner, it's up to about 40%. That certainly sounds like good news. There are 10 million firms. They contribute about $3 trillion, I'm sorry, to the U.S. economy, but there's always a but. The performance metrics for female-led new ventures lag behind those of male-led new ventures. Our companies tend to be less profitable, and our four-year survival rates also are lower, although I am glad that EJ's data shows a somewhat different trend when you look at high tech overall. So let's move on. I think that enough of the data and the sad statistics. What do I think is going on, and what do I think that we can perhaps do about it? So first, I think it really is true that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. We start businesses for very different reasons. We start businesses to achieve more job flexibility and autonomy, and men start businesses to achieve economic and financial objectives. Not surprisingly, we face more competing domestic demands on our time. And as a result, female entrepreneurs tend to have fewer hours on average to invest in growing their ventures. Female entrepreneurs tend to start somewhat lower risk and lower return businesses, and I think EJ's data supports that. They're more often in personal services and retail. Men are starting businesses in manufacturing and technology, and interestingly enough, male entrepreneurs more often create businesses that are less reliant on a local customer base. In addition, and this is a really, really important point, men are more often what we call serial entrepreneurs. That is, they start a business, they fail, and they start another business, or they start a business and they sell it, and they start another business. And in the process of doing that, they establish a track record. They become known to investors. They become known in the world of business. And interestingly enough, as I have spoken with investors in California, and particularly in the Bay Area and areas of this state that focus very heavily on life sciences, the VCs actually view that serial behavior and even that failure as a mark of being tested, as opposed to creating greater risk for entrepreneurs. It creates less risk, whereas investors feel that a serial entrepreneur, whether they have been successful or failed, has been tested. You know, they know what works, they know what doesn't work. So this willingness to do it over and over again, even if there is failure, is actually something that works to the advantage of an entrepreneur, especially when it comes to securing financing. And I think you may remember EJ's data from this morning where he said that about 0.6% of women are, in fact, serial entrepreneurs compared to 1.2% of men. So I think the bottom line is that often in forming our businesses, we are looking for ways to stop and smell the roses, and that's a good thing. And men are very, very highly motivated to make money. But surely the data indicates that we are no less capable, but it is worth acknowledging that our preferences and our mindsets and our behaviors in the business world are different. Now, another important observation that I would make, about women as entrepreneurs, and these are things that I think we can start paying attention to and do differently at the individual level. I call this help me help you. You may have heard the joke about the person who prays every day, God, please, please help me to win the lottery. Every day, God, please help me win the lottery. And one day a booming voice echoes down and says, I hear your prayers. Help me help you buy a lottery ticket. successful women entrepreneurs report that one of their major hurdles was accessing venture capital. And according to the Center for Women's Business Research, only 3 to 5% of venture capital goes to women. And in life sciences, this is the lifeblood, very, very critical to the startup and indeed the support of life sciences companies across what is often a very, very long business cycle. Nearly all angel funding goes to men. And as I said before, men are more often serial entrepreneurs. They have a track record. They have relationships. But here's the interesting rub, as far as I'm concerned. We don't ask as often for angel funds. And someone asked that earlier today. They said, well, do we ask? And the answer is fewer than 10% of the requests for angel dollars come from women. And look at this. When we do ask for money, there is almost no difference in the extent to which we receive dollars. So help me help you. Show me the money. Ask for the dollars. Entrepreneurs know this, and I will remind women of this, that investors invest in people. Investors tell me this all the time, and as I have sat in many, many, many review sessions with investors, so I know that this is true. They invest in people, and they say that they would rather invest in a good person who has a lousy idea, lousy technology, than a great technology that is being stewarded by someone whom they consider to be less aggressive, less capable, less talented. So, we need to show our stuff. I mean, all of the data indicates that when we compete, we compete well. So we need to not be afraid to compete. A related issue is this. Ask and you shall receive. Ask less and you shall receive less. A recent study of the institutions that are affiliated with the Harvard Medical School, so we just start now, at a level where we know we're dealing with world-class institutions. They found that their female and male investigators had equal success of winning grants from NIH. But here's the rub. Women requested fewer dollars, $115,000 on average for their grants versus $150,000 for men. And not surprisingly, they got fewer dollars, $98,000 on average versus $125,000 for men. And women generally request smaller loans from banks than men. So when we look at this behavior across the life cycle of starting and bringing a company to the fullness of its maturation, we see an interesting trend. We ask less often, and we ask for less. So I would suggest that if we ask for more, we may receive more. Again, I will tell you from the perspective of an investor that the amount of money that you ask for is often a very important indicator of whether or not you truly understand what it will take to start and grow a successful business. So to say that we should ask for less because maybe it will be easier to ask for less is often exactly the wrong way to go about this. Investors have a good sense of what it takes to bring a product, bring a therapeutic, bring a device to market. And they can gauge whether or not an entrepreneur really understands the process of bringing a product to market, be it a therapeutic, a drug, a diagnostic. They will look to see whether you've asked for what appears to be the right amount of money. So please, as entrepreneurs, don't sell yourself short. These are all things that we can do as individuals. These are simply behavioral changes on our part. A third thing that we can do as individuals, use the old girls' network, but in a pinch, the old boys' network will do fine. We often lack the network that is critical to successful corporate fundraising. I think you heard Lydia talk about this earlier this morning in her comments. And there really are fewer mentors. A study by NC State showed that Caucasian men receive more information about business opportunities of all types, jobs, money, networking opportunities, through their networks than do women or racial minorities. Now, the good news is that when we as women do serve as mentors, we more often serve as role models, and we more often provide psychological support for our protégés. It's a little bit different than a male mentor model. Male mentors more likely advocate on behalf of their mentees. Female mentors encourage their protégés to become self-advocates. So it's the difference between, as we hear all the time, giving a fish versus teaching to fish. Now, I think when it comes to accessing funds, to getting introductions, it's great. I think male mentors can be very helpful, but female mentors really do try more often, studies show, to pass on what they've learned, to pass on their skills, as opposed to simply lending a hand. So I think one of the really important things for us to remember and to do is to find a mentor and to be a mentor. We really do mentor very differently. One of the things I find in entrepreneurs in the life sciences is what's very helpful to them in establishing their credibility and getting their funding is whose lab did they come out of? You hear that all the time. Oh, he or she is from XYZ's lab. And if we go all the way back to the importance of some of the data that we looked at from the academic settings, it means that many of the top labs are going to be run by men. So there are certainly very important roles that male mentors can play, but I think it's incumbent on all of us in this room to get actively involved in being mentors. And for our younger colleagues in the room, please make sure that you find yourself a mentor. Some other things that I think are going to be important for scientists, and especially women scientists, as they move into entrepreneurship. One is to understand the difference, the very fundamental difference in the mindset, the training, the orientation, and the performance metrics of science versus business. In science, we're very focused on our methodology. We are generally, there are always the politics, but we're generally open to sharing. We publish. Information is available in various types of databases. The demand is it valid? Is the work valid? What is the measure of success? It's our prestige and it's our contributions to the scientific body of knowledge. It's our publications. And the life cycle is usually progressive. It's a longer-term development in terms of our careers. We hear very often, you know, about getting that career-making NIH grant, you know, and how long that can take and how many young scientists are leaving the field because it has taken a long time as NIH, with all respect to NIH, has been under budgetary constraints for some years, changing now very happily. But what about in business? Look at the differences. In business, the focus is on the result. Often, the ends justify the means. The value is really competitive advantage. How does this enable me to win in the marketplace? The demand is really about utility. Is it useful? When our scientific advisory board reviews grants and applications for funding from the Life Sciences Center, we have a so what factor. This is really great, interesting research, but so what? Does it translate into the marketplace? Success, sadly, is financial performance and shareholder value. And these are very, very important stakeholders, the shareholders. And the life cycle here is a tremendous emphasis on accelerated development. Get it out of the lab and into the marketplace. So for all of us who aspire to be entrepreneurs, there's a real need to be open to a blend of these paradigms, to really understand the demands of both science and business. My experience is also that entrepreneurial success requires emotional intelligence. I think most of you who have come up through the STEM path certainly would have gone through a training process that was anchored in data and analysis, was highly respectful of critical thinking, a healthy skepticism about accepting things on faith, deductive reasoning, and validation. And one of the things I wonder is whether or not scientific training to some extent squelches some of the non-empirical skills that are critical to successful entrepreneurship. There's a body of knowledge that is called emotional intelligence, which really means understanding your own emotions, but those of your stakeholders, what motivates your stakeholders, learning how to read the signals, read the politics, how to navigate your way through some of these tricky situations that require more intuitive thinking, feeling as opposed to observing. Emotional intelligence often enables one to manifest thought as action. You know, it's just willing to leap across the chasm. So comfort with big leaps of faith, appetite for risk, inductive reasoning, and benchmarking. In other words, I'll just go out and I'll look at a few examples, and that's fine. If I can see 3 to 5 pieces of data or 3 to 5 opinions that suggest that I might be going in the right direction, then I will move forward. So I would say, you know, that finding the right balance between critical thinking and so what I would call technical skills and observational capabilities and emotional intelligence is very, very critical for success in the business world. You just sometimes have to be able to go with your gut. And if it's true that there is such a thing as women's intuition, and my father has always said that if my mother has a feeling, a gut feeling about something, he always will make a decision based on what she thinks. So if it's true that we as women are blessed with women's intuition, we should use that. And again, I realize that often this really flies in the face of the training that as scientists we go through, but it's very, very critical to success in the business world. Again, very often it's just a good gut feeling. Another important issue that successful entrepreneurs must do is developing what I call your managerial DNA. In the course of my career, which has involved starting a company that we spun out of the larger company where I used to work, and now starting up the center, which really was a relatively non-existent entity, so I have had to really staff it, get all the policies and procedures in place, as well as ramping it up to do the business of being the Life Sciences Center. A couple of things I would pass on to you that have been my experiences and things that I found easier and harder to do. On the easier side, you have to remember that you as the executive own the vision and the strategy. And again, I think that our training as scientists, as physicians, as engineers, there's a collaborative process, and that's very, very important. But as an entrepreneur or as an executive, the buck stops with you. One must intervene quickly to address problems. Again, I think that as women, these are things that we probably are comfortable doing to sort of assess an issue and decide how to handle it. Whenever possible, test your ideas with the market. I find that this is something that scientists in general are less trained to do. I spend a lot of my time as a consultant having to tell disappointed scientists that it's just nothing that anybody wants. It's really a cool technology, but nobody wants to use it. There's a real need to constantly interface with the users, with the stakeholders, and the need to communicate. These are some things that I think are challenging, but I found somewhat easier to do. These are some of the things I found a lot harder to do. And maybe it's because my orientation, the way I was raised as a woman, is a lot more about multitasking and needing to do everything. But these are things I would pass on to you. Empower your team. Set your expectations. Delegate them to your senior team and then get out of their way. You can't keep your hands in everything. Stay agile in your decision making. Know when it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. And I think that we as women often want to do the right thing, want to go through the right process. We will collaborate, we will ask. We want things to go well. Sometimes as an entrepreneur, you just have to make the decision and go with it. And if it's a good decision, you're the heroine. If not, you ask for forgiveness and you move on and you do it again the next time that the situation presents itself. You're the control tower. Stay on top of the big picture. And again, I think as women and I think trained in the STEM professions, we are very comfortable with details. We're very comfortable with data. With lots of information, but as an entrepreneur, your focus is on the big picture. And something that I think men do better than women, unfortunately, but I think it's true, you've got to prioritize and compartmentalize. I think that we as women are really trained, raised to pay attention to lots of things at one time. And I have always been amazed at how men can compartmentalize their lives. Those of you who have husbands or had fathers and brothers, I'm sure know what I mean. They can just kind of focus on one thing and not think about anything else that is going on that needs to be done. But it's often that kind of laser focus that is very, very important to entrepreneurialism. So let me say a little bit about the Life Sciences Initiative in Massachusetts and what we're doing to try and address some of these issues. I'm going to give you a very quick description of the initiative because this is not intended to be a commercial for the Life Sciences Initiative. But as you heard Vivian say, last year the legislature and the governor of Massachusetts enacted a 10-year, $1 billion commitment to life sciences, and life sciences writ large, biotech, pharma, devices, diagnostics, and bioinformatics. The intent is really to make Massachusetts one of the top places to be if you are in life sciences. And I think we would all agree that California and Massachusetts share that honor. We juggle back and forth between who's number one and number two in any given year. But the mission at the center is really one of not only supporting good science, but supporting good business and driving economic development with life sciences, which means promoting entrepreneurial behavior. It means investing in the success of our growing companies and our already large and successful companies. So our top priorities, and these are priorities from our life sciences cluster, are to fund early stage companies and promote technology transfer. So I pay a lot of attention to entrepreneurs and to researchers who are in the area or doing translational research. Promote workforce development. Obviously, that means focusing on STEM. It means thinking about the role of women and other underrepresented members of the population in life sciences. Strengthening the ability of our academic medical institutions and our universities to compete for top talent as well as dollars, and just serving generally as a convener and a coordinator. We have dollars at the Life Sciences Center to invest in infrastructure around the state, so capital projects and medical equipment, dollars to invest via grants, dollars to invest via loans to young companies, and tax incentives that we can make available to larger companies. And I'm very honored to be in this role. Yes, when I first came to take on this role, I was the billion-dollar woman, the billion-dollar CEO. I've spent a lot of time setting realistic expectations because for those of you in the audience who are in the life sciences, you know that $1 billion would be a dollar bills that probably would fill up this room, or another way to show $1 billion is a single pill. So what it takes to bring a life sciences therapeutic device diagnostic test to market is really quite expensive. So we are trying very hard to make sure that women are well represented in this activity. I'm thrilled that Lydia Villakomaroff, our own Lydia, is on our board of directors, and her strong presence and voice have been invaluable, as well as her perspective, not just as a scientist, but as an entrepreneur. In addition, the Secretary of Administration and Finance, who is a woman in the Commonwealth, this is the CFO of the Commonwealth, is on our board of directors. In terms of our scientific advisory board, which is chaired by Dr. Harvey Lodish at the Whitehead Institute at MIT, we have four women, two of whom are scientists, Pat Donahoe and Lila Garosh. But we also have Jean George, who is a partner with the VC. And Advanced Technology Ventures, ATV, is one of the premier VCs in the area of life sciences. We also have Allison Taunton Rigby, a scientist and an entrepreneur. So she has a small company. So we've really tried to bring on our SAB not just the scientific perspective, but the perspective of the investment community and of the entrepreneurial community. Let me say just a couple things about our programs. One of our most important programs this past year was what we call our Accelerator Program. And for any of you who are familiar with the life cycle of small companies and especially life sciences companies, you know that there's something called the Valley of Death, which has stretched in this economic downturn into a plane of death. It's quite long. But it is really that period or those periods of time when entrepreneurs are challenged to find funding to continue, to go on to the next stage. They need more data. They need to hit certain milestones to demonstrate that their product is viable. They need to determine that they can get through the regulatory hurdles. All of this takes money. And one of the things that we at the Life Sciences Center wanted to do was to help early stage companies by providing them with the working capital that they need to achieve those milestones and to be more attractive and less risky to private investors who in this economy have really pulled back from risky investments. And early stage companies are certainly seen to be risky investments. We funded seven young companies. I'm very pleased to say that one of those companies is headed by a woman, Janet Wolf of Wolf Laboratories, which provides quality assay and process development for bio and pharma companies. She has won numerous awards as an entrepreneur and a very successful entrepreneur in Massachusetts. But even she was facing some challenges in trying to grow her company, in being able to access working capital. So we were very proud to invest in her company and have every great expectation that that will be successful. So of seven companies that we funded, one company is headed by a woman. I must say very few of the applicants were headed by women. So one of the ways that we're hoping to address that is by funding a little earlier on. And we have something that's called the New Investigator Matching Research Grant Program, where we are making 2 to 3 year grants available to young scientists around the Commonwealth. This is usually in advance of their having received any NIH dollars or NSF dollars, but our SAB believes that they're doing some very interesting work that has high commercial potential. So our hope is that these young investigators may be the next round of entrepreneurs. I happen to believe, and this is my hypothesis, but we heard this morning that female entrepreneurs, especially in technology, have a very, very high rate of patent acquisition. And I happen to think that that's because in life sciences, at least, many entrepreneurs do come out of an academic setting. They're doing research in the academic setting. They're developing concepts, prototypes, and they decide that they will take them out into the world as an entrepreneur. Most academic institutions have a technology licensing office that works with their faculty to get their work patented. And so what my hypothesis would be that that may be why we see many women who go into the technology fields as entrepreneurs showing that they do, in fact, have patents. But long story short, of the 28 research grants that we awarded, about 25% were awarded to women. I think you can see a very nice distribution across the institutions in Massachusetts. So we have very talented women investigators in all of our institutions across Massachusetts. And I'll just give a shout out to the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, which actually has more female-headed labs, I believe, than any of the institutions I have seen in Massachusetts. I don't know what they're doing there, but they're doing a lot that's right. Very, very high percentage of female scientists and female-headed labs. And finally, so we're helping young entrepreneurs. We are helping young scientists and doing all that we can to encourage women to apply for our grants. We also, based on a study that we did of workforce development needs in the Commonwealth, sponsored a summer internship program. We have heard companies say over and over again that they need entry-level workers who know their way around a lab. This is both the case for academic labs and labs in life sciences companies. So we sponsored a challenge program where we provided the stipends and we encouraged companies to come and take a look at resumes, which were placed on our website. We had 500 undergraduates from around Massachusetts who either are residents or going to school in Massachusetts place their resumes, and we had 104 matches. The good news is that half of those interns were women. Very, very proud of that. When I stood in front of all of the interns as we were kicking off the program, to look in the audience and see all the young women made me very proud and very excited. The other thing about this challenge is that because we provided the stipends, we made it possible for smaller companies, younger companies, to participate, because they very often couldn't afford to pay for an intern or didn't know how to go about finding an intern the way that the very large, well-established companies do. So the good news is that almost all of our interns actually went to earlier stage companies where they had a chance to sit at the table with the entrepreneurs. And since so many of our interns were women, these were women who were getting very direct exposure to what it means to be an entrepreneur. What are the tough decisions that have to be made? They got a very, very valuable and hands-on work experience. Finally, we at the Life Sciences Center have wanted to do more to quantify the workforce needs in Massachusetts. What are the skill sets that are required? What are the demographic breakdowns of who is really participating in our training programs, who is being hired? And we've been using this data in a variety of ways. It's being used across the Commonwealth by academic institutions and companies to really document what are the needs for future generations of life sciences workers. We have generated a lot of interest in professional masters of science degrees and hope to be able to support the development of a shared curricula for many of these programs. We have really been able to foster a lot of good cross-training between the STEM departments and the business schools at a variety of the universities around Massachusetts, and a real emphasis in exposing the top students in science to entrepreneurship in addition to marketing and finance. Lydia mentioned the Science Club for Girls. We're very active with them. We certainly recognize that we need to reach out to younger women and get them involved in these professions much earlier. So these are some examples of things that we are trying to do at a programmatic and policy level in Massachusetts. But again, I wanted to balance that by saying that I do believe that there are behavioral changes that we as women need to make that will improve and enhance and accelerate our success as entrepreneurs, because the capability is there. So let's keep moving forward. Thank you again for inviting me, and I'm happy to take questions.